Dear Hank and John.
Nor as I prefer to think of it, Dear John and Hank.
It's a comedy podcast where two brothers answer your question, give you dubious advice, and bring you all the week's news from both Mars and AFC Wimbledon.
How are you, John?
I'm doing well, Hank. As you know, it's Olympic season, which can only mean one thing in our family.
It's the Marble-lympic season!
that is actually correct. Right now, in our house, we spend 12 hours a day watching the proper Olympics and 12 hours a day watching the Marble-lympics.
To be clear, I love the Olympics. I think the Olympics is great, and I love these times when this sort of feels a little bit more like we're living in a globally productive society, and we're connected by things that we like rather than things that we hate. And yes, but also the Marble-lympics, John.
Oh, the Marble-lympics. It's just fantastic. Every year, Henry and I go all in on the Savage Speeders, and every year the Orangers break our hearts.
So for the people who don't know what's happening, there's a YouTube channel called, do you know how to pronounce this, John?
Yella?
Yella's Marble Runs?
Yeah.
And they are, it is a channel of marble races and other marble competitions. And this happens all year round, but then during Olympic seasons, both summer and winter, there is a Marble-lympics where marbles compete against each other in various events like high jump and speed, downhill speed runs, and other. There's a bunch of teams.
Yeah, marble curling.
There's marble curling, which apparently this year they canceled the marble curling because it was too boring, and he's recreating it a second time.
Yeah, well, I for one found I find every moment of the Marble Olympics absolutely engrossing, and it is outlandishly entertaining, impossibly entertaining, and it just goes to show you that while times are dark on parts of YouTube, on other parts of YouTube, the Marble-lympics are showing us all how we can come together and hate everyone who roots for the Orangers.
I've been rooting for Team Galactic, and that's not going super well. So my backup team, which is a new team this year, the Midnight Wisps, have been my team, and they're actually doing quite well.
Our backup team is the Oceanics, which also...
Oh, that's Catherine's team, and they are not doing well.
They have not had a good Olympic so far, but the arc of history is long, and it bends toward the Savage Speeders.
Well, I'm really excited to see how the Marble Olympics goes this year. It's fun. It's especially good viewing for commercial times, because when you're watching the Olympics, you can't skip the commercials because it's live. And also, it's the same commercials over and over again. And like, yes, I'm aware that you want me to buy an exercise bike.
Yeah.
Or whatever.
There's a lot of Chevrolet commercials, man.
Yeah. Yeah, they would like me to know that Chevrolet has won a lot of awards. And look, good on you, GM. Thanks for making cars that people use.
Hank, I'm not going to say that until and unless GM comes and sponsors this podcast. I do want to say something else, though, of great importance. You may remember the amazing, amazing tiger poem I read written by a six-year-old last week here on the pod.
Mm-hmm.
That poem is published in a book, and you can buy the book. The book is called You Will Be Able to Say 1,000 Words, and you can buy it, and it will support 826 DC, which is an awesome organization that brings free writing programs for students between the ages of 6 and 18. So we're going to put a link in the show notes to that book so that you can buy it. I have bought a copy. If that tiger poem is any indication, the book will bring me so much joy and consolation.
Cool.
All right.
Sweet. Excellent. And do you have a poem for us today, John? Also, you can find the Marble Olympics by just Googling Marble Olympics or Marble Olympics. It's not difficult to discover if you would like to enjoy this piece of pure joy in which you can see marbles competing against each other. Completely free of, you know, any of the human story that goes into the Olympics.
Right. Both the great thing and the problem with the Olympics is that it's full of human stories. The great thing about the Marble Olympics is that you get to impose human stories upon marbles. And that in general, for whatever reason, it just works much better. I don't have a poem for today, Hank. We're going to skip right into the questions. This first question comes from Ellen, who writes, "Dear John and Hank, I have two dogs and two cats. If my dog, Winston, brings me a ball to throw, I throw it. And both Winston and one of the cats chase it, and the cat gets there first. But Winston is ultimately the one who returns the ball to me. In this situation, whose ball is it? I purchased the ball. Winston is keeping the activity going, but the cat is the one on the other end of my throw. So who is actually in possession of the ball? If a fight should break out between the three of us, which one of us has the right to keep the ball?"
Oh.
Not gelling like a felon. Ellen.
Well, Ellen, I have heard it said, and I don't know what this means, that possession is 9/10 of the law. So I guess there's a 90% chance that whoever is holding the ball owns the ball.
Well, whoever is holding the ball in a moment probably owns the ball in that moment. The question is, legally, who has the right to sell the ball?
Ah, well, I see. So the situation, Ellen, is that you own both your dog and your cat.
That would be my argument. My argument would be that even when the dog owns the ball, you own the ball because you decide, like, when you say Winston, drop it, and he's like, no, and then you say Winston, drop it again, and he gets that sad-eyed look on his face.
Uh-huh.
That's because he knows he's going to drop it.
Right, or else you're going to sell Winston.
Oh, God, Hank, don't take it. Oh, God.
Don't sell Winston just because he won't give you a ball. John, the thing that interests me most about this question is the idea that can a ball be owned by no one?
I mean, I almost think that it has to be owned by no one in this case. It's a bit of a Schrodinger's ball situation, really.
Okay, I think the ball is definitely not alive, but also kind of not dead, I suppose.
No, it's just that the ball is in more than one state at the same time. Like,
right.
the ball is both Winston's and the cat's. P.S., did the cat not get a name?
I don't think the cat was named. I think it seemed to be that it was one of the cats, and there's multiple cats, and we're not, like, maybe it's a different cat each time. It's unclear.
That's pretty brutal, Ellen. You know, to have one named pet in your home and just refer to your other pet as the cat, that's brutal.
Right. Yeah, can we name the cat? Can we name it like Sharpie is the first thing that I saw on my desk?
That's great. I love it. Yeah, so I think the cat belongs to all of you together, and you have to make votes about its future, and it's a majority rules situation.
The ball or the cat? Is it the cat that everybody owns, or is it the ball?
Yeah, no, Winston owns the cat, the ball owns the cat, and Ellen owns the cat, and all three of them have to vote about the cat's future. That's what I'm sticking with.
It's a democracy now. It's a co-ownership situation, and everybody has to own exactly 1/3 so that nobody has a voting majority there.
That's right.
Though I guess if you get 2 out of 3, then you do decide what to do with the ball. I recently wanted to, John, do a project for Awesome Perk where I gather river rocks and I paint them and put hanklerfish on them, and then I realized that I didn't own those rocks. And that actually someone did, that being the United States government.
Oh, boy.
Because they own everything. They own the land. You can't just take stuff. It's very strange that everything, it's kind of like everything is owned by someone. And there are these times when, like, suddenly objects transfer ownership from you and, like, sort of implicitly, but also maybe legally. Like, when you put an item in a trash can, that item becomes owned by the garbage company. It's not yours anymore, kind of, actually. And if a stranger takes something out of that trash can, are they stealing from the garbage company? Or is that owned by no one? I think that they're technically stealing from the garbage company.
Can I ask you a follow-up question, Hank?
Yes, please.
If, for instance, there are 200,000 to 300,000 aluminum cans, full back doors, rubber tires that appear to have once belonged to four-wheelers, etc., in the White River at any given moment.
Uh-huh.
Does all of that belong to the government?
I think so.
I feel like it might belong. I feel like it might be my problem. I was kayaking. It got briefly warm enough for me to kayak here. And when I say briefly, I mean for like 12 minutes. I was kayaking upriver and I literally passed a door going downriver. It had a doorknob in it.
Wait, but John, did you try to open the door? Because maybe if you'd gotten the right angle and you could just like open it up, there'd be a Narnia situation.
Yeah, that is exactly why I didn't open the door. I like my life. I'm not trying to fall into some other dimension. I saw Outlander. I don't want to be removed from my family. No, I did not open the door. I did immediately think if I open this door, I'm going to lead a completely different life and go to a different dimension and live in a world probably where, like, I don't know, Snicker bars are sentient or something. But I didn't open the door. Let's move on to questions from another question from our listeners. We've gone too far down the rabbit hole.
Okay, I've also just Googled who owns trash, so I definitely feel like we need to take a turn into, what did we call it last week? Hard normal or something?
Hard normal. This next question, it's you. You ask it.
It's my turn. This next question comes from Des, who asks, hey, Hank and John. That's not the name of the podcast, Des. Jeez.
That was a little aggressive, Des.
Hey, when you go somewhere and you accidentally take some ants with you at home... When you go somewhere and you accidentally take some ants with you, do they just fit right in or to the ant colony wherever you end up? Or are they put in a constant state of anxiety because their loved ones are nowhere to be found? Worried about ants, death. Okay, first of all,
Hank, this note has a P.S. and you chose not to read the P.S. God, and that I cannot believe that you chose not to read the P.S. Holy snood.
I'm just bad at this, John.
God, the P.S. is can't wait to read an absolutely remarkable thing, which is Hank's book. It comes out in September, and it's available for pre-order now. And Hank just blatantly refused to read the P.S. about his own book and how somebody is excited to read it. Okay, now go on. Do ants experience ant anxiety when put into a colony that is not their home colony?
It seems that deaths frequently accidentally takes ants somewhere.
Well, that's true for any of us.
Do I?
Oh yeah, sure. Picnic baskets. Okay. That seems like the major way.
Okay. Is this like hitchhikers on the cuffs of your pants?
Yeah. Just answer the question. You're the science person.
So usually these ants die.
That's nice.
Well, to be clear, every ant dies, and that's just how it works. ants have... there are no immortal ants. We've determined this. Ants have basically, I don't know, I think they call it like a passport pheromone, maybe is what they call it. And for some ant species, the passport pheromone is species-specific. So any ant can go to another ant colony, and they'll just like, hey, what's up, Steve? How's it going? You're an ant with us now, but many, and in fact, I think most ant species have colony-specific passport pheromones, and if they show up at a new colony, they will be killed as an invader, I think. But sometimes ants with... This actually happens. Sometimes ants with passport-specific, colony-specific pheromones get incorporated into a colony, even though they probably shouldn't. The ants are just sort of like, oh, I get it. I see what this is. It's not an attack. It's just Steve, who, you know, got here in the picnic basket from the lake. But this all does depend on the ant finding a colony of the same species to integrate into. If they don't find a colony, they will die. Because they need the support of the colony to survive. And if they find a colony of a different species of ants, they will definitely get killed.
Okay. All right. So you're saying there's a chance.
I'm saying there's a chance. Sometimes even two colonies will come together and form a single colony, which is pretty unusual because usually colonies consider each other antagonistic.
Wow, that's interesting. I don't want to get too deep into comparing ants to humans. ... Let's move on to the next question.
Before we do that, let's plug the YouTube channel Ants Canada, because if you're looking for weird YouTube channels that are about very specific but amazing things, Ants Canada is a really great one as well. And there are different clans of ants that are taken care of by this ant guy, and he's really excited, and just, it's one of my favorite ways to spend 15 minutes.
You plugged Ants Canada last week.
Did I? Okay.
Yeah, you've now officially plugged Ants Canada more than you've plugged your own book. This next question comes from Beth, who writes, "Dear John and Hank, my name is Beth, and I'm an optical dispenser. My job is to help people choose new glasses, and many
Wait. Optical dispenser definitely sounds like a machine.
No, it doesn't. It sounds like a person. She dispenses the opticals.
Is that a phrase from another country? To me, you dispense, there's two situations in which you dispense something. One, you are a vending machine. Two, it's marijuana.
No, I think three, it's glasses. My job is to help choose new glasses, and many people I help get a huge amount of anxiety when selecting new glasses. Yeah, no joke, Beth. Me too.
Oh, yeah.
Many people want to change their look but don't know what to look for, whereas other people very much don't want to change their look and get upset when we don't have the exact same glasses. So I come to you, Brothers Green, as Hank really hasn't changed the look of his glasses much, and John has changed multiple times. I'm a big fan of your current pair, John. They do good things for your jawline. Thank you, Beth. I feel like you may have some excellent dubious advice. How do I get people to feel more at ease when choosing their glasses? Oh, it's not easy. I mean,
no.
It's funny you should mention that, Beth, because I'm reading your question through lenses that I can just barely see out of, because I like these glasses, but I am nervous to even try to get new lenses into them, because what if they break and then I have to get new glasses and it would be such a nightmare.
Yeah, I'm looking at your glasses right now, John, because I could not call them to mind.
Sure.
And they do look nice. I think that they do look nice, and they do nice things for your jawline. And I don't think that your neck is disappearing at all the way that some people in Vlogbrothers comments for some reason are saying.
Well, it's fine. It's good, because the nice thing about people criticizing my appearance is that I don't actually worry much about my appearance, but I do worry about what horrible diseases I might have that are resulting in these changes to my appearance. So spent a lot of time Googling what might be wrong with my neck. Anyway,
oh no.
Moving on.
I worry that my teeth have changed shape over the years and that they're moving around. It's really actually pretty amazing to have at least one video of me talking every week for the last 11 years. So I can go and be like, was my tooth like that before or is that new?
It turns out it's
been that way for at least 11 years. So I think I'm okay.
Yeah, no, it is a very weird thing to look at your face for several hours a week while editing.
Yeah.
One's videos, and I don't think that it is particularly good for one's overall quality of health, but I like making Vlogbrothers videos, and I'm grateful for the opportunity. But to get to Beth's question, Hank.
Okay, let's do it.
What, in your experience, what have been things that people have said that have helped you pick out glasses?
Well, I think it helps to have somebody who you trust a lot. So in general, establishing yourself as an authority is actually something that can go a long way. And ways to do that are to say, hi, I'm Beth. This is what I do. And my clients include Nicolas Cage.
No, no, that's
Lindsay
terrible
Lohan,
advice. No. Yeah, what a famous glasses wearer,
Lindsay Lohan.
The last time Hank meaningfully engaged with popular culture was apparently 2007. Anyway, that is terrible advice. It is good advice to establish your authority, but the way you do that, I think, is saying, "Hi, I'm Beth, and I am an optical dispenser, and for the last X number of years, I've worked with people to get them glasses that fit well and that they like the look of, and that's what I want to do with you, and it may take a while, but we'll be patient, and we'll get something that you're really happy with." And I think encouraging people in that way, and then I really like the specificity you used, even when talking about my glasses, where you think, what the glasses bring out, what they help with, what the downsides might be. You know, if the mm-hmm. lenses are really small, it might affect your field of vision, etc. Just showing your expertise through calm, generous, kind readings of the situation, I don't think that's going to make it an unanxious experience for a lot of people, because it's a big choice. It's you know, the one thing that I wear every single day for years at a time. So it is a big, important choice in someone's life.
Yeah, and it's on your face, man. It makes your face look different. And when I take my glasses off, people are like, oh, okay.
Yeah,
that man?
Yeah, I don't look like myself without my glasses. So,
yeah.
I mean, I think one thing I like about your question, Beth, is that you obviously understand why your job's important and why it helps people. And I think if you just bring that attitude to it, that you're there to try to help people and try to be a calm presence in a difficult situation, I think that's the right track to me.
Absolutely. And then, you know, what helps me, honestly, is having Catherine there, because Catherine, I feel like, is the one who has to look at me all the time. And so ultimately, it's more her decision than mine.
Sure.
This next question comes from Niv, who asks, "Dear Hank and John, I'm a 17-year-old girl, and my parents, at least my mom, is hell-bent on making me study math for my undergrad, while my dad is a bit more cool, note only a bit, with me doing economics, the love of my life. I feel like I'm letting my parents down by not being enthusiastic about getting a degree in maths. I love the subject, but the syllabi for a good math course is cover all the topics I utterly despise. How do I break the news to my parents that I might not in fact be doing math and that I will be doing economics to go on to become like the president of a country or a successful business person with no regrets? Live long and prosper, Niv."
Isn't economics and math the same thing?
What I gotta say to Niv's parents is, come on!
Yeah, I mean, your child could be studying 12th century French poetics. By the way, I know
Which
there are people
fine.
In our audience who are studying 12th century French poetics, and I thank you. That is good and noble work. But I mean, from the perspective of parents who are worried about your
future, they're worried about, yeah,
in business,
it's
I think studying
like,
economics, you're going to be fine, Niv. Just study economics.
Like,
just,
is this like a long history? Do you have like generations of mathematicians in your family? Like, is your great 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 grandfather like Gauss or like some other famous old mathematician, Blaise Pascal?
Yeah. I mean, even Pascal, though, wasn't just a mathematician. Can't you make the case to your parents that you're going to learn a lot of math along the way to your economics degree? And also, it seems to me that economics majors are very employable. Like, can you just promise your parents you're going to do a math-focused economics study?
Yeah, it's clearly not the concern. If you're trying to get a job, economics is definitely better than pure maths. Though, and often if you have a math degree, you're going to end up working in something related to economics, like finance. But in terms of like put aside job training, I'm not interested in that argument, because it seems like your parents probably just want you to continue the line of the hundreds or possibly thousands of years of mathematicians in your family.
Yes.
And what you say to that is, I want to do the thing I want to do. And you didn't have a child because you wanted the child to become one particular thing. You had the child because you wanted the child to be able to decide and make good things happen that they wanted to do. That level of control either is sort of outsized in your own mind, Niv, and you are sort of perceiving too like more pressure than they intend to be putting on you to choose one specific career path, or it's just too much, and they should not be doing that, and you should be choosing to do the thing and feel free to and excited about doing the thing that you love and you want to do.
Alternately, I don't know if there's a double major in your country. I know a lot of places there aren't double majors, but it seems like it'd be easy to do a double major in math and economics because half the classes are the dang same. Like, I took an economics class in college, and it was all flipping math. I mean, Maybe I don't understand what math is, but it felt like math to me. There were a lot of numbers, and I had to use those numbers to create a lot of geometrical curve shapes. So I don't know. It felt very mathematical. Anyway, we wish you luck, Niv. I'm sorry that you're going through this difficult time. I hope that you get to pursue all of your passions in life. I want to get to another question, though, Hank. This one comes from Hella?
Yep.
All right. She writes, "Dear John and Hank, my name is Hella, and I grew up on a farm that my family has owned for over 300 years.
Wait, is this like the mathematician question, except with farms instead?
Yes. I am the second of four children, all of whom are now adults. According to Oldersret, my older brother has first dibs on the farm, then me, and then our younger sisters. Oldersret, by the way, which I'm very sure I'm mispronouncing, is the ancient Scandinavian thing where that decides how land gets passed down through families. It is very old.
Oh, my goodness.
And it has its own Wikipedia page.
According
to that, my older brother has first dibs on the farm, then me, and then our younger sisters. It has always been expected that one of us should take over the farm, as it is the norm, but all of us have moved away, and I'm pretty sure none of us actually want to be farmers. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with being a farmer. It's just not really for me. Our father brought it up a few years ago that we should decide who gets to take over the farm. And, well, is it wrong to want to sell a farm that has been in our family for several hundred years? Do we owe our forefathers to sacrifice enough to keep this farm in our family? There's no guarantee that we would be able to find a buyer that would keep the farm a farm, but I know that I really do not want to be a farmer. Ever since I was a little girl, I've been quite squeamish around a lot of the stuff that happens on a farm, and I really have not grown out of it. But have you seen how many movies there are where the people who want to sell the family farm are the villains? No silent ease, Hella."
I feel like maybe in Norway there are more of those films, because I haven't seen that many.
I've seen a few.
But it would appear that, like, this is a pretty important and big part of Norwegian culture that I had no idea about, just from reading the Wikipedia page for Oldersret, which I think I just knocked that pronunciation out of the park. And it is a fascinating law, and it is the actual existing law in Norway. And if somebody who isn't in the family buys the farm, the family members have the right to get it back, which is currently about 10 years. So they can just buy it for the additional price plus the cost of any improvements. If you get rid of the farm, you could get it back potentially, though there are also rules about making that not a thing. But
I bet we have different opinions about this.
Well, I mean, ever since I came to Montana, I have had a different sort of feeling about farms and families and like the seriousness of this. Not that like I think that this should this is how, you know, should impact you. It's just like my understanding of this has changed a lot, having known farmers, been friends with generational farmers and also new farmers, and seen the kind of like the difficulty of that job. It is a very difficult and not particularly thankful job in which you have to live far away from population centers, and that is pretty isolating, and it is a difficult thing to do for a living, and also the strife and difficulty that it creates within families when you have this extraordinarily valuable thing, but you don't like the way of turning that, you know, that huge amount of land, you know, compared to what most people own in terms of land, into money is a really stressful, difficult thing, because you're always taking out loans to buy the seed and to work the land. And then at the end of the season, hopefully you can pay those loans off. And that happens every year. And it's just really intense. But also like that responsibility that people feel to their ancestors, and to the institution that they have been raised in and part of for their whole lives, but also for like their entire sort of like imagined cultural history, which is a very real thing. It's the intensity of that is, you know, like I wouldn't have understood it if I hadn't seen it. You know, I certainly haven't experienced it firsthand, but I've seen it secondhand.
Yeah, I mean, my feeling is that you should wait. Hella, you shouldn't make the decision now if you don't have to. You know, maybe right. your father's saying, I want to know what the future holds, but I think you can say, well, you know, right now you have the farm and we're so grateful that you do. And we love it and we want to support you in any way that we can. And when it comes time to make a decision, we will make a decision. Because I also don't think that you can really know how you'll, not only how you'll feel, but how your at least three mm-hmm. siblings will feel when the time comes to really make the decision about, you know, if there comes a time when your father feels like he can't do the work or can't oversee the work, then you have to have that hard conversation. But I think you have to have it with all of your siblings because it is so complicated, Hank, as you say. I mean, there is something very powerful about knowing that this is the place where your ancestors' bones are, in many cases, literally, and certainly that, you know, you're doing the same work in the same place that they were. There's something powerful about that and something comforting about that. But at the same time, it's very easy to romanticize that. And Hella, having grown up on a farm, knows that, in right, fact, yeah. the actual work is utterly unromantic.
Yes, can confirm having farmer friends.
That is, yeah, I mean, yeah. You have to slaughter exactly one animal before you completely lose the sense of romance.
Yeah, I agree with you, and it doesn't sound to me like you've had a ton of conversations with your siblings about this, especially. And I would suggest definitely having those conversations sooner rather than later.
Which reminds me that today's podcast is brought to you by Conversations with Your Siblings.
Conversations with Your Siblings. It's the whole podcast. This podcast is also brought to you by Generations of Mathematicians. It stretches back deep, deep into your family history, and you can't go into economics because of it, I guess, maybe.
And today's podcast is also brought to you by Ants Canada. Ants Canada, Hank won't stop promoing it.
And of course, this podcast is brought to you by the Marble Olympics. Marble Olympics available at Yella's Marble Runs on YouTube, where you can spend your commercial time while watching the Olympics, watching non-human competitors made of glass.
We also have a real sponsor today, Hank, and I'm actually literally opening up my RX bar right now. I don't know if you heard that, but I am so excited about this sponsor because it is a product that I really, really like. I'm going to have a bite while you talk about it.
I mean, it's kind of shocking to me that you still have any RX bars. They sent us a pack of them, and I...
I bought these.
Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah, they are they're an energy bar. I have to eat fast quite a lot, and I like to actually have a variety of kinds of energy bars. It's nice that we live in a world where that's possible now. And these ones are they are tasty. They are healthy. They are a really good sort of intermediate snack because they don't have like too much in them. So it's not like I'm eating a whole meal. It's not a meal replacement. It's sort of like a get me through to the next meal amount of food. And they're easy to eat. And I like the taste of them a lot.
Oh, they're delicious. They're incredible.
They're sort of like the new they're made a lot of figs is sort of the stuff that binds it all together.
And then dates.
Dates. Are dates and figs different?
I don't actually know, but this is so delicious.
So they're made of figs, of egg whites, and
dates.
Of...
It's still dates.
They're made of dates, egg whites, and nuts, pretty much. And then there's like flavoring to make them taste good and different from each other. And there's both like fruity flavors, like raspberry and blueberry, and more sort of like chocolatey flavors, like chocolate peanut butter and that kind of thing. Salted chocolate is a really good one.
Yeah, but it just has like very clear ingredients. Like on the front of it, it just says 3 egg whites, 14 peanuts, 2 dates. And the only other things it has in it are chocolate, cocoa, and sea salt. It is a great... I am a genuine fan of these RX bars. Anyway, you can go to rxbar.com/dearjohn or rxbar.com/dearhank and enter the promo code dearjohn or dearhank at checkout and get 25% off of your first order. And I'm telling you, you are not going to be disappointed, especially yeah. with the peanutty ones. I'm more of a peanut person than I am an other nut person, but they're all, honestly, they're all really good.
I do. Yeah, they come in 11 different flavors. I have had, I think, all of them. I think they sent me all of the flavors, and I didn't not like any of the flavors I had. They're good for breakfast on the go, snack, throw it. I like, if I'm getting on an airplane, it's really good to have something just in case I'm going to get hungry suddenly. Pre or post workout, it's really good because they're not like too intense and aren't going to like overwhelm my system and make me feel bad while I'm exercising. And give me heartburn or anything. And I just like it.
Oh, they're delicious. Again, that's rxbar.com/DearJohn or Dear Hank. And you enter the promo code Dear John or Dear Hank at checkout. You get 25% off your first order, and you're going to love
go
it.
That.
I'm almost done with mine. Oh, well, I've got so much energy to get back to the podcast, but I'm talking like a chipmunk because I got a lot of stuff in my mouth. All right, let's go.
John, this next question comes from Crystal, who asks, Dear Hank and John, why should I pre-order Hank's upcoming book, An Absolutely Remarkable Thing, comes out September 25th, available for pre-order now, 7 months in advance? I could pre-order the book in early September. In the meantime, use that $20 to, like, I don't know, invest in the stock market, put it in the bank for small interest, or dig a hole to bury it in the ground. P.S. It comes out September 25th and is available for pre-order now. Best regards, Crystal. Oh, Crystal, thanks. Thanks for doing the hard work for me.
All right, Crystal, I want to offer you a couple of futures in which you're going to be very grateful that you ordered Hank's book 7 months in advance. Future number one, the entire world economy has collapsed.
Okay.
Everything, the stock market, the has collapsed. But not only that, all of the savings accounts, people, there was a bank run and people tried to get their cash out, and it turned out the FDIC couldn't insure all of the deposits.
Sure,
and suddenly the money that you had in the bank is worth pennies on the dollar. But you know what you have, Crystal? You have a physical, a really beautiful physical object, a hardcover book that you can use not only for reading and consolation, but also when it becomes necessary to beat off the invaders that are attacking you because the social fabric has completely disintegrated, or
if it's an absolute
emergency, to start a fire.
Or barter, because everyone knows that this book is worth the amount that it was when you purchased it. So it was when you bought it, it was worth, you know, $20 or whatever.
Sure.
And then now it's still worth $20 actual money, even though $20 bill might be only able to buy you like a stick of gum. So this thing is the new currency of the future.
That's right. In the future, people are just going to be handing around hardcover books in exchange for eggs
and
tomatoes.
Not hardcover books, John. just the one book. It's basically Bitcoin. It's my book is... It's a cryptocurrency.
That's right. It's a
As a book.
Crystal, get in on the ground floor of this exciting new cryptocurrency that comes with a physical book.
Oh my God, if that hasn't been done yet.
It is in no way a pyramid scheme, Crystal, but if you don't get in at the very beginning, you will lose all of your money. Crystal, the real reason to order Hank's book now is so that you don't forget to do it later, and also because it helps the publisher measure enthusiasm and excitement about the book, and it is very helpful to both the future of the book and the book's author when the publisher believes that there are lots of people who are excited about it. So really, if you have been considering pre-ordering Hank's book, please do. Please do it now, really. It is, and I'm not just saying this, I wouldn't just say this, I would find ways to talk about it that weren't dishonest, but I wouldn't be as effusive as I'm about to be. It is a really, really wonderful book, and it explores what now feels like so fascinatingly, and it explores what fame feels like, and the way that it distorts your worldview, and the way that our general worship of fame has distorted the wider culture in really fascinating, moving, brilliant ways. It is a special, special novel. So you will also be grateful to have been in on the ground floor of the story of an absolutely remarkable thing. But the biggest thing that you can do is help the book and its author by communicating to the publisher that people are excited about it.
Yeah, and that has happened, and so the people I'm working with are at Penguin have been so supportive and excited, and so I really appreciate everybody who has pre-ordered. It really does help, and whether you do that online or whether you go to your bookstore, and if you're wondering how you pre-order something at a bookstore, you go in and you say, "I would like to pre-order this book," and they will say, "Okay, we'll call you when it's in," and that's that. And it works.
All right, Hank, we've got a question from MP who writes, "Dear John and Hank, when you're on the phone with someone and the call drops, who's in charge of calling back? The originator of the first call since they started it? Or should you think of it as taking turns? I often panic and quickly try to decide if I'm the more adult person in the conversation. Mm-hmm. And if so, I should take the reins and call back. But even I know that's not a great method. Please help me to adult better. Bad at avoiding social awkwardness. MP."
What happens when we drop a call? It's usually like we both do it, right? Like
we just call back at the same time, and then sometimes we both get busy signals. And then a lot of times I'll be on your voicemail, and I'll be like, "Why don't you pick up your phone? We were talking 30 seconds, and I'll see you." And I'll be like, "Oh, right, he's trying to get to me too." Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
We need a system for this, Hank.
But
it is
what
an inefficiency.
The system? Is it like the younger person? Because you have to have some like objective thing. Because the call drops for both of you at the same time. So it's not something to do with the context of the phone call. It has to be
right.
Something beyond that. So like whose name comes first in the alphabet kind of thing.
I like that. It's who's the name that you usually use to refer to that person. So not necessarily their given first name. Whatever, it, you know, if you call them Shrimp, then Shrimp. If you call them Apple, then Apple, whatever it is. The first letter of that name that you use to talk to the person whose name is closest to the beginning of the alphabet is the person who does the callback. Caveat, if more than 5 seconds pass, then it's a complete free-for-all, because then you start to worry, like, well, did they hang up on me on purpose, or did they get in some kind of horrible accident? Like, is there an emergency? That's where my head goes immediately.
Right.
Is there an emergency? So don't say, "Oh, well, you know, Apple hasn't called me back. I guess that Apple just thought the phone call was over." Do call them back, because for all you know, they might be out of the bottom of a crevasse. I once called Sarah after badly injuring my knee while trying to walk up the hill after kayaking. And if Sarah hadn't answered the phone, I probably would have just stayed down there for 127 hours.
John, what if the phone call is between our cousin Mike and our uncle Mike?
Oh, that's something I hadn't thought of, and that's a great point, Hank. What if it's
they
a
have
Mike
the exact
talking
same
to a Mike?
Name. Yeah, not right. Only they have the same last name, too.
I think it goes to the middle.
Goes to the middle name?
I think it goes to the middle name. Now, in the case of our cousin Mike and our uncle Mike, unfortunately, that is not a tiebreaker. So then I think you've got to go to junior or senior, and since comes before in the alphabet, I think our cousin Mike calls back our uncle Mike in that situation.
I think that also would happen just by virtue of the fact that our uncle Mike would be like, "Mike's gonna call me back."
Oh yeah, no, I can't see our uncle Mike really rushing to
do
reconnect
anything.
That phone call.
Yeah, just
I love my uncle Mike so much. He is an amazing, amazing person. I admire
cool.
so much about him. He is the coolest. He is such a cool guy. However, if there is a disconnected call, the chances that he's going to call me back are well below zero.
It's just negative. Negative chances that you're going to get the call back from Uncle Mike.
Speaking of negative chances, Hank, can I share with you the news from AFC Wimbledon?
Oh, no. Oh, no. Oh, I'm sorry. I've been following, and I feel like I shouldn't be. Am I bad luck?
I don't know, so good in January, so very, very, very bad in February. AFC Wimbledon have slipped back into the dreaded relegation zone. Currently in 21st place, just ahead of the franchise currently plying its trade in Milton Keynes. Hank, I am not a professional script writer of third-tier English football.
Yeah.
But if I were writing the narrative of the 2017-2018 season, I think we all know where it goes from here. It comes down to the last game of the season on May 5th, and either the franchise is going down or the Dons are going down, and the pressure is unbelievable, and I vomit 35 times that morning, having flown from the United States to England the night before, and I'm completely unable to enjoy myself, and really, regardless of the outcome, I don't know if I'm going to be able to be happy. That is where the narrative of this season is headed. There are still 14 games to try to avoid that narrative. But yeah, I mean, it's been a very, very bad February. That's really the only thing that can be said about it. It might change. Hopefully it will change. But the Dons lost 4-2 to Plymouth Argyle, 3-1 to Northampton Town. And that was after a 2-1 loss to Bury. So it's been a difficult week. We've got a game against Bristol Rovers coming up. And then Peterborough. I don't know. It's just been a bad month, man.
Yeah. I mean, you're scoring goals, too. Like, none of these are nil numbers.
Yeah.
It's like the most recent was like 2-4, and it's like 2 would have been good enough in the first half of the season to win like every game.
Yeah, I know. It's just been, it's just
weird. Are they
weird.
pushing the defense up to try and increase scoring opportunities?
Really. I watched all three of these games that we've lost, so maybe I'm bad luck, actually. Although we also lost to Rotherham. I know everybody's sure. Criticizing my pronunciation of it, but I'm not going to back down. Anyway, I watched all three of these games, and they just look like behind the game. Like they don't look like they're running at the speed that the opponents are running at. They just look kind of confused at the back. I don't know. It's frustrating and pretty scary, but we'll see where it goes from here. I mean, I just really have to hope that the Dons find a way to stay up.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I feel like you're just having a run of bad luck, and then it's going to come back.
I hope you're right. What's the news from Mars?
John, so you know the Mars 2020 rover, getting ready to go to Mars. You also know that sometimes pieces of Mars actually end up on Earth. And this is one of the ways that we've been able to study a little bit more about how what Mars is like, because we haven't ever been able to like bring a piece of Mars back for us to hold, but because of, you know, asteroid impacts and you know, various times in the history of the solar system, pieces of Mars have actually been blasted into space. And then occasionally one of those pieces of Mars will land on Earth and we will find one. Now, we've done that a number of times, and these Martian meteorites are extremely prized, and all of them are, you know, in scientific institutions and being studied. One of those Martian meteorites, a piece of it is actually going to be sent back to Mars.
Wow.
On the Mars 2020 rover.
Wow.
And this is not like, this is not just a reunification to say, hey, Mars, you lost this. We found it and we wanted to bring it back to you because, you know, possession is 9/10 of the law. So we're not saying that this is yours, but, you know, it's not exactly ours either. So, but because there's this instrument, it's called the Scanning Habitable Environments with Raman and Luminescence for Organics and Chemicals, which, if that sounds like a really awkward acronym, it's because it is. It's an acronym for Sherlock, is how that comes out in the end. It needs a calibration target to know exactly a bunch of things about this rock. And thus it can like calibrate on the rock, and then it can like get better, more precise data about the rocks that it's measuring on the surface of Mars.
Huh.
And they wanted to use a rock that was Mars-like. And so instead of like picking a rock that on Earth that had a lot of Martian, like Mars-like properties, they are using a piece of Mars that we found on Earth.
Wow. Wow.
This is pretty freaking cool.
That is pretty freaking cool, man. That is science.
So, I've only about 200 Martian meteorites only 200 meteorites have been confirmed to be from Mars. So this is a pretty, you know, next level thing to do, but it's very cool.
That is cool. Well, congratulations on your forthcoming Mars reunification project.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
I can only hope that in 2020, when that happens, AFC Wimbledon will be playing in the third tier of English football in their new home at Plough Lane. But time will tell. In the meantime, Hank, what did we learn today?
John, we learned that ants have special passport pheromones that allow them to know whether or not an ant should be friends or you kill them.
We learned that the Marble Olympics is arguably the best Olympics, but definitely in the top two.
And we learned that my new book, An Absolutely Remarkable Thing, comes out September 25th and is going to be the next big thing in cryptocurrency.
And lastly, we learned several ways not to pronounce Oldisret.
Oldisret.
All right, Hank, thank you for potting with me. Thanks, everybody, for listening. We're going to go record our patrons-only podcast This Week in Ryan's right now over at, you can find out more at patreon.com/DearHankAndJohn. But thank you again for potting with me and to everybody who listens and sends in your questions. I'm sorry we don't answer more of them. They are an absolute delight to read, and it brings us so much joy to be able to do this every week.
And thank you, John. This podcast is produced by Rosianna Hals-Rojas and Sheridan Gibson. It's edited by Nicholas Jenkins. Our head of community and communications is Victoria Bongiorno. Our music in the beginning and the end and for This Week in Ryan's is by the great Gunnarola. And as they say in our hometown, don't forget to be awesome.